you can trace the history of the Black American experience in part by listening to Sunday sermons over the generations.
But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop.
That's the way it's going to be. When I get to the toll booth in glory.
It says the Spirit helpeth our infirmity, which means the Spirit comes together.
I'm not praying for myself right now. I'm believing God for that which concerns you. I need somebody to yell glory.
The voices of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend William Jones, Bishop Joseph Patterson, and Reverend Claudette Copeland. A new anthology has collected these and other important African-American sermons stretching back 250 years. Martha Simmons co-edited the book. It's called Preaching with Sacred Fire, and she joins me from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Reverend Simmons, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Now, your book catalogs all of these amazing sermons, starting in 1750 up to the modern day period with more familiar preachers like T.D. Jakes. Can you basically reconstruct the Black experience in America by reading through these sermons?
I think you can. And in addition to the sermons, each section of the book begins with a brief contextual history of what was going on when particular sermons were preached, to say to you, this is what a preacher was addressing and dealing with as they preached this sermon.
I want to pick out a few of the sermons to ask about. And I want to start with a man named John Chavis.
Yes, indeed.
He was born in 1763. An amazing story because he served in the Revolutionary War. And
then
he became the first person of African descent in this country, ordained as a Presbyterian preacher. Tell me, would John Chavis, I mean, he was a free Black man living in the South, in North Carolina, in the 18th century, end of the 18th century, would he have had access to people who were enslaved? Would he have been able to preach to them?
Oh, no doubt, because it was often the case that even slaves were allowed to sit in white churches as long as there were overseers there who could watch them.
The sermon that you have in the book is actually reads more like a letter. It's actually called a letter upon the doctrine of the extent of the atonement of Christ. And we have a brief excerpt of it. Here's a reading of it.
And I rode on, one of the most miserable of men, and found no peace of mind until I became satisfactorily convinced that the atonement which our Savior had made was commensurate to the spiritual wants of the whole human family, that he had made it possible for each individual to be saved.
Obviously not recorded in the 18th century. The technology was not available then. But in the book, you write about the natural bridge between the oral traditions that those who were enslaved brought with them from Africa and how that sort of melded into an oral tradition in Black American Christianity. At what point did Black preaching kind of become, you know, something more visceral, more holistic, more exuberant?
If you listened in African villages, and I had a chance to a few years ago visiting South Africa, and people were having church outdoors, and I heard them chanting, and I thought I was in an old church revival service somewhere in the Deep South.
Wow.
And in talking to some of the elders in the group, they talked about it as always having been that way.
You write about a variety of different styles, sort of cadences, and we have a recording, and this is from the early 1940s. This is C.L. Franklin, and he became known for his style known as hooping. That's the Reverend C.L. Franklin, and that sermon was called The Eagle Stirreth Her Nest. And we believe this is from 1941. This is actually Aretha Franklin's father.
Absolutely. This is her father. And she would sing in groups that he would put together. And then on occasion, he would preach. And so you hear, if you listen to him very closely, the music that's in his throat and in his preaching, just as it is in his daughter's.
Reverend Simmons, as you sort of look at the modern-day landscape and look at the modern-day Black church and the most influential preachers, for example, T.D. Jakes, do you see any kind of trend in the way that African American preachers are ministering or are delivering sermons?
One of the trends that we've noticed in the last 15 or 20 years is that the preaching is so much faster than it used to be. It's sped up just like all of culture has sped up. The other thing that we see, we're seeing more of a return to what's currently being called prosperity preaching.
One of those preachers who sometimes is known for prosperity preaching is, of course, T.D. Jakes. He has a mega church in Texas. We have a recording of one of his sermons. Let's take a listen for a moment.
Somebody holler, take me higher. I've been thinking too low. I've been looking too low. I've been asking too low. I've been hanging around people who talk too low.
And Reverend Simmons, you talk about T.D. Jakes as an example of what you call a black empowerment preacher. And his style, I mean, resonates with millions of people. I mean, not just African Americans, also white Americans, Latinos, and others.
Well, I think most of all, T.D. Jakes is just a solid preacher. I'm not surprised that his style would appeal to a wide audience because his energy and its fervor in terms of his approach would be engaging. And then whether there's some whites, some blacks, Latinos, Asians, what have you, who are interested in empowerment or prosperity messages.
When you think about the historical progression of the sermons in this book from 1750 to 2010, is there a quality you see in today's preachers that can be connected, a continuity, a clear line of continuity stretching all the way back to 1750?
The one thread that I saw through all of the material was this notion of enhancing the self-esteem of the people to whom you preached. And you could go into black churches, north, west, east, south, any Sunday, and I think still hear that thread often lifted. It makes sense that that thread would run all the way to the present.
That's historian and Reverend Martha Simmons. She is an associate minister at Rush United Church of Christ in Atlanta and the co-editor of the new anthology of African American sermons. It's called Preaching with Sacred Fire. Reverend Simmons, thank you so much.
It's been wonderful to be with you.
Before Victor Hugo created his character, Inspector Javert for Les Miserables, before Arthur Conan Doyle formed Sherlock Holmes, there was Eugène François Vidocq, a flamboyant 19th century French detective. He was real, and his crime-solving inspired those detective novels. It also inspired the Vidocq Society. Founded in 1990, its members meet monthly in Philadelphia for lunch and solve the cases the police have given up on over their soup. Author Michael Capuzzo has just published a book about this exclusive club called The Murder Room, and he's in the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you, Leanne.
What's the difference between the Vidocq Society and the Baker Street Irregulars, which is a kind of a club, a gathering of Sherlock Holmes scholars and fans?
Well, the Baker Street Irregulars is a wonderful club that exists for entertainment and inspiration, and the Vidocq Society started out that way as a social club of great detectives and forensic specialists from around the world, but evolved rather quickly into a pro bono crime-fighting society attempting to sort of, address the issue of unsolved crimes and help people catch killers who have caused great harm to their families.
How does one become a member of the society? There are 82 members
Eugene now? Eugène François Vidocq was born in, I think, 1775 in Arras, France, and died in, I think, 1857. I hope I'm doing the math right. But he lived 82 years and is one full member for each year of Vidocq's life. And I think they have something like 50 associate members at the moment. Who all bring the full members have to be reputed and known to their peers as among the best detectives, forensic specialists, blood spatter experts, pathologists in the world. And so there are people from the, agents from the Scotland Yard connections and Interpol and NYPD and a lawyer who was on the commission investigating, the JFK's assassination and Martin Luther King and terrorism experts and sadism and white-collar crime and psychics and just about anything you could imagine. I think of it as sort of a CSI on steroids, but sort of real.
Huh. The society was formed by three men, William Fleischer, a federal agent, Richard Walter, a profiler, and Frank Bender, a forensic artist. Fleischer had a picture of Eugene Vidocq in his office. How did the 19th century detective influence crime solving? Why did he fascinate Bill Fleischer?
Well, Bill was a Philadelphia born and bred, and he had a troubled childhood, which he'll happily talk about, and is in the book. And when he came across he thought he would end up as either a criminal or a cop. He was getting into fights and sort of a juvenile delinquent. And when he came across as a young man, and then in the FBI Academy, when he was becoming an FBI agent, the story of Eugene Francois Vidocq, I think he found his sort of doppelganger, his spiritual twin through time. Vidocq, first he was a criminal and a notorious sort of highway robber and an escaped prisoner, sort of the Willie Sutton of his time, and then eventually convinced the French police chief that there should be such a thing as the Sûreté, the sort of plainclothes intelligence officers who would think a little bit more about the motives of criminals, which is the first time that had happened. And he pioneered that as well as the first private detective agency.
Talk about Richard Walter, the profiler. There couldn't be two more different men. William Fleischer, he's got a beard and he's rather corpulent, but Mr. Walter is like this sliver of a man.
That's a great...
In a blue suit with his nose always seeming to be up in the air.
Right, exactly. Richard really is a sort of a prototypical thin man, and he wears one blue suit and drives one dark blue Crown Victoria, and until they both wear out, then he gets replacements. And he smokes cools every 20 minutes a new one. And he is the most sardonic. I mean, they call him the living Sherlock Holmes at the Philadelphia DA's office and the Hong Kong police and Scotland Yard and other places he consults, because he really is one of the tops in the world. And rather flamboyant when you look to act and sound like Sherlock Holmes. But he's a sort of old school Victorian gent who prattles on about having values and standards, and then, you know, roars like a sailor, things you can't let people even hear. You know?
And then the third musketeer in this trio is Frank Bender, probably best described as one of those lust-for-life artists.
Oh, that's beautifully put. Frank recently lost his wife of many years, Jan, to cancer. And Frank also has fatal cancer and mesothelioma. And in one of these sort of stories that I guess shows the peculiar capabilities and flexibility of love, they loved each other desperately for decades, had a child, grandchildren. And Frank at the same time had, I think, 76 girlfriends while he was married. He gave me a list of the names. And he was sort of a force of nature, and it always worked for Jan. He says that, in this sort of narcissistic genius kind of way, that his ability to follow all his desires allows him to float in some sort of ether and be a sort of psychic detective. It's sort of true, as strange as it sounds.
Can you take us into one of those lunches and, you know, how does it work?
The way it works is that the Vidocq Society meets in an old sort of walnut-paneled room in Philadelphia across from Independence Hall. It used to be a men's club, and there are men and women in the club. And the police will come in, or the Kansas Bureau Investigation, or, you know, often assisted by family members or prosecutors, on cold cases where there are innocent victims and the trail is cold, and they're sort of at a court of last resort asking the Vidocq Society for help. And then in this case, you know, they show up and they make a PowerPoint presentation. So it's this fairly nice, elaborate lunch of four courses and the white tablecloth round tables and the glittery room. And the fifth course is the headless corpse up on the screen. In this case, Dr. Kenny Andronic and Zoya Asur. Zoya was a sort of lovely, 26-year-old Russian immigrant young woman who was going to college in New Jersey, and her fiancé was this successful doctor, and she disappears in the Pine Barrens, this case is unsolved for years. I should say up front that Dr. Andronic has never been charged, although he's been publicly accused of the crime.
When was this? Give us just a place and time.
This was in the early 90s in New Jersey, and Zoya Asur had been shot, and fairly obviously, I think, if you look at the evidence, she was murdered. But then again, it's not my job. It's the New Jersey authorities to determine that. And Richard Walter did a profile of him, of this doctor. And, you know, that's an unresolved case. You know, one of the lessons of the book is it's not always a happy ending.
It took them a while to be able to begin to solve some cases. And do you think people thought that they were just a collection of almost, you know, academic thinkers about murder when they weren't getting results?
Yes, I think that's a good point. I think what happened is it was a sort of beguiling idea, a charming idea, and before they knew it or realized it, the New York Times was writing about them and calling them the heirs of Holmes. And the day the New York Times was there, the reporter was in the murder room. They discussed a sort of iconic serial killer case of the Cleveland Torso Killer, who was a sort of American Jack the Ripper of the Depression era. But that's an important story, and it's wonderful if we could find a resolution. But it's a little bit, it was like a parlor exercise. But then even if you read the New York Times story at the time, they're kind of implying, the reporter's saying, couldn't you be helping people? I mean, there's this sort of natural human tendency to want to find justice. And I think the Vidocq Society members realized that they had this time and talent. And, you know, the numbers are really sort of dismaying. I mean, an estimated 100,000 Americans have gotten away with murder in the last 30 years and are still floating around. And if you talk to Richard Walter about it, and this is how he speaks, he says, and I think that's just wrong.
Michael Capuzzo is the author of The Murder Room, The Heirs of Sherlock Holmes Gather to Solve the World's Most Perplexing Cold Cases. He spoke to us from the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Austin, Texas has been home to a lot of innovation in the computer industry, in the world of independent music and film. Now, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the Texas Tribune is seeking to reshape journalism for the Lone Star State.
John Thornton is, above all, a pragmatic guy. He should be. He's one of the most prominent venture capitalists in Texas. A few years back, Thornton considered investing in a few distressed news outlets.
As we look at the commercial news business at the firm, from a for-profit standpoint, I came to the conclusion that public service journalism is not a very good business, and in fact, it's a public good.
As an investor, Thornton recoiled. As a citizen, he put up some of his own money, rounded up some other big-dollar donors too, and launched the Texas Tribune as a not-for-profit online news outlet last fall.
We're not all the way there yet, certainly improving it, but we think there's a model that combines premium content, membership, and corporate sponsorship that will allow us to run this shop without having to go continually to foundations and wealthy individuals, and so that's the road we're on.
Thornton picked a celebrity in Texas journalism circles to be his CEO and editor-in-chief, Evan Smith, the acclaimed former editor and publisher of Texas Monthly magazine. Together, they've stocked their small newsroom just a few blocks from the state capitol building with talented reporters from several major Texas newspapers and TV stations, a key editor who helped lead the New Orleans Times-Picayune to two Pulitzer Prizes, and an environmental reporter from the New York Times. Evan Smith says the Tribune News team intends to hold politicians accountable.
So every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, we're treated to the spectacle of people coming to our communities asking us to rehire them. And we have no basis for making that decision. We know so little about what they do and don't do in the capitals in Austin and Washington, what laws they do and don't vote for, what policies they'd support, what shenanigans they have or have not been involved with.
The site is rich with video interviews with political figures and plenty of original audio stories, too. But Smith says the Tribune defines what's newsworthy in unconventional ways. So during those Fort Hood shootings, when the state and national media descended, the Texas Tribune stayed away.
Mostly, in baseball terms, we hit him where they ain't. We didn't go following their reporters down the same rabbit holes and do the same stories. Inevitably, in a year of a governor's race, we're all going to be in there swinging at it. But primarily the stuff that we've been doing on health care and on education, on immigration, was stuff that they were not doing.
The Tribune is also seeking new ways to provide readers with context, like the campaign feature called Stump Interrupted, inspired by VH1's pop-up videos, in this case, showing Governor Rick Perry on the hustings.
Men and women who campaigned as Republicans went to Washington, D.C. and started voting like Democrats. They spent too much money.
That ding kept a running count on how often Perry disdainfully invoked Washington, and that signaled a pop-up caption with additional information. Another hallmark is serving up reams of raw data. Who did Kay Bailey Hutchinson's major donor support after she lost in the Republican primary for governor? Check the Tribune's database. The text of the state attorney general's lawsuit against BP is there, too. Eric Wright lobbies in Austin on energy and healthcare issues.
Information and insight is the currency of politics, right? They seem to provide a wealth of that.
Some critics suggest Tribune only attracts political insiders. But Smith and Thornton say only a quarter of its visitors come from Austin, and that web traffic is exceeding expectations. In the meantime, the Tribune is expanding its reach by collaborating with anyone who's willing, even some would-be competitors, like Christopher Lopez, executive editor of the El Paso Times.
We are picking up their stories and publishing them in the print newspaper because it gives us another well of political content.
Some collaborations have had an impact. With the Houston Chronicle, the Tribune revealed staffers at a state-funded center had forced disabled girls to fight one another. So the journalism appears to be moving ahead briskly. The finances are more of an open question.
Nobody knows exactly how this is all going to turn out.
Jim Barnett is a longtime newspaper reporter who now blogs about not-for-profit news outlets for the Nieman Center at Harvard University. He's a fan of the Texas Tribune, and Thornton in particular.
What I think he saw there was an opportunity to transform the news source into what is really a cultural asset that people will value, and they will do more than what is necessarily required of them just to get that service.
The Tribune now has 2,000 members, much as people become members of public radio stations. Thornton's target is 10,000 over 3 years. But I still had one nagging thought.
Why is this your fight?
I ask myself at about 4 o'clock every morning that exact question. I really did become passionate about this idea that an informed society, a functioning democracy, requires public service journalism.
David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The best and brightest Pokemon players from 26 countries are in Kona, Hawaii this weekend, locked in competition. Each one hopes to take first place in the 2010 Pokemon Video Game Championships. The Pokemon franchise exploded in popularity when it began in Japan back in 1996. 2 years later, it spread to the United States, and today it's second in sales only to Nintendo's Mario series. To play Pokemon, gamers wander through virtual worlds and collect adorable creatures. There's a tiny blob known as Jigglypuff.
Jigglypuff!
The electric rodent Pikachu.
Pikachu!
And the fire-breathing dragon Charizard. Players then train their creatures to fight in battle. 16-year-old Wesley Morioka of Chicago is the United States' top-seeded senior competitor. He estimates in the 11 years he's been playing the games, he's put in close to 3,000 hours of practice. And that's some serious work for some serious fun. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow, two astronauts aboard the International Space Station will put on their spacesuits and go back outside to finish a repair job. A cooling pump on the station failed 2 weeks ago. That's left the crew inside without a critical backup system. The astronauts have already been out twice. One of the spacewalks lasted more than 7 hours and occasionally sounded like an episode of This Old House.
Okay, I see pocket A, and I think I can get it in here with just releasing the starboard.
You should be able to just release the flap on your left hand there, and down at the right side should be a sleeve that's sewn in that the coiled side of the vent tool will go in.
NPR science correspondent Joe Palca has been watching the space station repairs, and he joins me now. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Why is replacing this pump so important?
Well, these cooling systems are absolutely essential because there's a lot of equipment on the space station, electrical equipment. It makes a lot of heat as it's operating. You got to get rid of that heat somehow. This is part of a complicated system where they have a refrigerator outside, and that cools water inside, which circulates and cools equipment and makes the environment cool. So they have to have it, and right now they've only got one system working. And when there's only one system out in space, people get nervous.
They get nervous because there's no backup.
Right. You can't go to call the HVAC guy, get him to come around in his truck. If it failed, this has been the question, if it failed, they would not have enough life support in the American part of the station. Ooh. They would all have to move into the Russian part of the station where they have a separate cooling system and live in there and only venture into the American part when they had a specific task that they wanted to perform. So it's bad if the other one breaks.
Well, they've already done two spacewalks to try and fix this. Why has it been so hard to replace?
It turns out that it's like any repair job in a 10-year-old home. Mm. Things that you thought would be, oh, I'll just snap off this connector, they don't snap off. Mm. And so they thought they'd be an easy task to unbuckle four lines of coolant, and one of them wouldn't unbuckle. And they spent hours just trying to work at it and pull on it and twist on it. Then they had to wait a couple days, and they lowered the pressure. You know, all these kinds of things. But if it's a home repair, no big deal. But if you're out in space, you gotta think all this stuff through. It takes a lot of time.
And they actually keep all these replacement parts on the station, right? They've got this huge sort of storage facility.
Well, you have to ask yourself, okay, I've got X number. It turns out there's 14 critical components, and they figure out how long they think each one's going to last, and then they make sure they have spares for each one. In this case, they have four spares for a component that's absolutely critical that they think will last about 10 years. So they have to make a guess about how long it's going to last before it breaks.
Now, obviously, these astronauts are scientists. They're not there to repair things, but they have to from time to time. Does this repair affect the other experiments that they're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Every other station activity basically stops. Mm. There's a couple dozen experiments on board the station. They're being tended in the absolute minimum way to keep them going if they have to have any kind of attention. But everybody's preparing for and getting ready for and getting equipment ready for and going through procedures for these spacewalks.
That's NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks so much.
You're welcome.